My father, William, who died just about a year ago, was born in July 1922, the same month as the Irish Civil War began. And my father was born off the Shankill Road in Belfast, which is one of the most fiercely militant Protestant communities in the north. And he breathed in, as a boy, some of the infection of soul that really tore apart the life of a whole nation. And some of that infection was deep within him, within his upbringing. And I often, on a Sunday family meal, when there was extended family present, I, as a boy, would overhear uncles and other members in my family in conversation about, well, what is the answer for the situation in Northern Ireland? And I grew up hearing such things as, well, we just need to blow up the Falls Road, which, of course, was the Roman Catholic community. So this infection was very much in my father, even though he didn't live a life of violence or really consent to that extreme violence. He was reared in that community. And he migrated to Canada, and the last time that he crossed the Atlantic to see us in Scotland, he sensed, I think, that this was maybe going to be his last time across the Atlantic, and in fact it was. But in advance, he wrote me a letter and said that he would like to visit the south of Ireland. And he had never been there. Such was the division within himself. He had never visited the south. So I arranged for a cottage down in Dingle Bay. And on the first Sunday of our holiday in Dingle, I took my father into Dingle town, naively assuming that there would be a variety of churches to choose from. We could find only one, St. Mary's, and we had an absurd conversation outside St. Mary's, and because, you know, my life has been so characterized by ecumenical commitment and interfaith relationship. But there I was, standing outside St. Mary's Dingle, feeling apologetic to my Belfast-born Protestant father. And I said, you know, we don't have to go in there. And he said, no, I want to go in there. And I said, and we don't have to stay for the whole service. And he said, no, I want to go in there, and I want to be there for the entire service. So in we went, and there was a wonderful, blethering Irish priest on duty that day. And when it came to the intercessions, for instance, he was saying, now we pray for the weather, Lord. It's not been too bad, but it could be much better. And we have all these people visiting from around the world, Lord, and we'd like them to see our beautiful country, so we pray for the weather. And on he went. And I could tell that he was endearing himself to my father, who also was an Irish blether. But when it came to the celebration of the Mass, there was my Shankill Road father, going down the aisle with tears streaming down his face to receive the bread and the wine from a Roman Catholic priest from the south. Never in my life would I have imagined that would happen. Never. There is hope. There's hope for healing. And the same day, my mother, who is a Scottish Presbyterian teetotaler, agreed to visit an Irish pub with me. So, I mean, there's really hope for the world. So I saw the Dalai Lama being interviewed a couple of years ago, And he was asked, do you have hope for the future? And he laughed. And that's part of his beauty, that he laughs so much. And then after laughing, he said, of course I have hope. The future has not yet been decided. Do we believe that? Or do we live as if we believe the fragmentations and the separations that we're part of are somehow an indelible feature of life that cannot be changed? So this last journey of my father was a very blessed time. And after his death, I was so grateful that that had happened in Dingle, that he approached the end reconciled. Yeah. Thank you. If you have a comment or a question that you'd like to make, maybe you could make your way to the microphone in the middle here so that we can all hear. So anything at all that's been stirring in you, anything you'd like to observe or share, or perhaps a question, but whatever.
I love to come up here and demonstrate how to use the microphone. But I'd like to ask you, musician to musician, to speculate a little bit on harmony. Because we have these wonderful legends about through harmony, through heavenly harmony, this universal frame began. You know, that's Dryden, and that's the Ode to St. Cecilia. And we all smile and think, ah, harmony, isn't it wonderful? But when you get a little deeper, you realize that there is harmony, static harmony, which is always consonant, never goes anywhere. And we know, as musicians, that it's a combination of dissonance and consonance that makes a musical event happen. Does that unleash any thoughts?
Mm. Thank you. Well, relating that analogy to some of the theme of this morning, that is how to bring together what has been considered opposite. And I think that the road to healing being a bringing together of the so-called opposites, I think, can relate to this musical analogy as well, that we're not talking about somehow an erasing of distinctions. We're not talking about moving to something that is just moonlight consciousness or just sunlight consciousness. We actually need that tension of opposites in order to move into a profound meeting place and similarly between masculine and feminine, for instance, and so much of our culture, our religion has been dominated by masculine energy. And we're not talking about a stripping away of masculine energy, but knowing that it really comes into its own most deeply to the extent that it marries or moves into a conjoining with the feminine, allowing feminine energy a true and central role in marriage or in harmony with the masculine. So I think that's the way I would want to affirm the analogy as helpful to what we've been reflecting on, that it's not somehow a downplaying of the distinction and the separate notes, but it's a way of bringing those notes together in a way that we are actually hearing the two, but in relationship rather than in opposition. Yes.
And some of our churches were struggling with the words tolerance and acceptance. And can you talk about those words in relationship to your concept of harmony?
Thank you. I think that what we've been reflecting on this morning moves is inviting us to move beyond or further than tolerance. I think that one of the implications of how we've used tolerance anyway is that we will tolerate the other rather than actually come into relationship with the other. And to know that by coming into relationship with the one who is over one of the many boundaries that we have created to separate ourselves culturally or religiously or the sort of separations that we have imposed or been part of creating in relation to the species of the earth. So that the vision that I've been trying to articulate and that I sense as a vision that many of us are pursuing or yearning at a deep level is not just a toleration of the other, but a knowing that we need the other, that we need to be in relationship across these boundaries. I'm thinking of a great teacher, Simone Weil, W-E-I-L, who was a young Jewish philosopher who lived in France at the time of Nazi occupation and then managed to escape from France, although she tragically died before the end of the war. But Simone Weil, in part drawing from something within her Jewish inheritance that's very similar to aspects of what we hear in the Celtic world. I referred earlier today to the way in which the prologue to John's Gospel is sometimes paraphrased. In the beginning was the sound, and the sound was with God, and the sound was God. Everything is essentially a sounding of God. And Simone Weil says something very similar, and she says that everything is essentially a vibration of the sacred presence. And if that vibration were to be taken out of the universe, then everything would cease to exist, because everything is essentially this vibration of the divine presence. But one of the things that she says, and this is what I'm drawn to in particular from your question, is she says, once we become aware that what is deepest in the other is the vibration of God's presence, then when we bring our heart into relationship with the true heart or true essence of the other, she says that we are drawn towards what she calls our nuptial yes. Nuptial yes. In which we desire that what is deepest in us should marry or should come into co-union with the true heart of the other. So I think that what Simone Weil is pointing to is something, you know, way beyond tolerance. It's about moving into relationship with, and I think that that's where the creativity is. Certainly tolerance of the other is better than what we often get up to in terms of attacking the other, trying to destroy the other. But it's not yet at that place of creativity in which there's a nuptial, in which in a nuptial there's the birth of a third, there's a birth of a new reality. Thank you.
In the light of what you've been saying about our connection to the cosmos and being in God, how do you see life after death?
It's good to save the light questions until later in the morning. This, of course, is an enormous question, and let me try to dive in just somewhere as a way of offering a type of glimpse of response. I've been very struck by that, the term that Jesus uses when he speaks of being salted with fire. And he, of course, uses the image of salt elsewhere, but being salt of the earth. And we have such expressions that continue in the English language of being worth one's salt. And what are all these expressions about salt? And in the ancient world, and I think this is what Jesus was accessing, there was a sense that salt was almost like a quintessence. It was seen as an element that could be found in every composition, salt. So it was used as a way of pointing to the essence. And to be salt of the earth is to live in relation to one's essence. So that one's journey in life is a journey that takes us to where we will all eventually be. We will all eventually be salted with the fire of death. That's what all of us are moving towards. And at that moment, everything else will be stripped. Everything will be taken from us. We will lose all that we have. And in a sense, that moment of death is seen as the ultimate salting with fire. It will strip away everything except our essence. And we've been speaking about our essence as made of God, coming forth from the very heart of God. And of course, on the way to that ultimate salting with fire, we experience various saltings in which we are stripped, in which we lose some of what surrounds us. We will lose status, we'll lose possessions, we'll lose loved ones. And what is all this journey of being salted about? And what is the sort of ultimate salting with fire that Jesus points to? So that I think all of these images are pointing to having come from God, and in that ultimate salting with fire, we return into God. So that any question about life after death is for me related to coming back into our essence and having everything else stripped away, and knowing that none of these other things are what have any ultimate future. My status, my citizenship, my religious identification, my sexual orientation, all of these things are just, they're going to be stripped. And I think it is pointing, of course, to a very hard journey. It's a journey that in the Western world, so much of our culture and even religious inheritance has been quite keen not to look at that salting very closely, and to somehow pretend that that's not where all of us are moving. So the image is pointing to me of how do we now and now and now at every point in our life, how do we live in relation to the salt, our true essence of God, and how do we live with a type of open-eyed awareness that everything else is going to be stripped, so that we live in a hope not just of the saltiness of our being after the great salting with fire, but how do we live in relation to that true essence now? And how do we help one another through these salting times, being salted with fire times? And how do we move into that greater intentionality of choosing now to live in relation to our essence, as well as living in relation to a hope of that essence being of God, and therefore being greater than death. Thank you. All this talk of salt makes me a bit thirsty.
Yeah. Tough one to follow. By the way, Reverend Newell, I was vibrating when you mentioned about vibrations yourself a few minutes ago, and that is scientific string theory. My question is that about ecumenicalism, and I've been blessed to be on a board called the Interfaith Initiative for a decade. And I have been so enriched by that grouping and activity. It must come forth and multiply. The wisdoms of all traditions are, as you know, just incredible. So my question is, how can our board, how can we provide more and more avenues of unifying, getting together, and appreciating each other?
Thank you. The sort of simple response that I'd like to embellish on a bit, but the essence of the response that I'd like to offer is relationship, relationship, relationship. And that not only to move intentionally back into relationship across the boundaries that we've created, not only between religious groupings, but of course over the other many other boundaries, cultural and national, that we've created, and that faithful choosing to seek relationship and to wrestle faithfully in relationship is, I believe, part of the way forward. Every summer in the high desert of New Mexico, our time there is characterized by relationship, particularly within the Abrahamic traditions, so that we work very closely with a rabbi from Santa Fe and a Muslim teacher from Sufi Muslim teacher from nearby in New Mexico. And relationship was, to begin with, really pure gift, although it came out of me expressing a desire to the program director of the conference center where we were working. It came out of my expressed desire to him that we should be more intentional about relationship. And then he was the one that, in a sense, provided the gift of relationship. And we've been doing this now for about 10 years. And one of the things that struck me about that gift of relationship is how we have handled the gift. That is, how we have tried to be true to the gift of relationship. And to begin with, we felt a bit nervous about just how precious the gift was, and wanted to dance around some of our differences. But as that relationship has more and more deepened, and as we've come to really trust the love that is between us, it would be right to say that we've, on that basis, we've entered a time of really being able to wrestle much more in faithful relationship. And I think that that's a demanding time. We know that in all of the most important relationships of our lives. It is when the foundations of trust and confidence have grown that we bring the uniqueness and some of the dissonance of who we are in relationship into play. And that's the really creative time, I think, when we can wrestle faithfully and in love. And one of my observations, particularly from that ongoing summer relationship that we've had, is that my Jewish brother and my Muslim sister, to speak just of two from within that household, what they look to me for, in large part, what they look to me for or to be, is to be deeply true to Jesus. They're looking to me not to somehow leave my treasure on the side. They're wanting me to bring our great treasure from within the Christian household and to bring it into relationship and they have invited me in relationship to bring my treasure, just as what I expect from my Jewish brother is to bring his Torah wisdom. That's what I want. I don't want him to somehow play it down. We're not trying to pretend that there aren't these real distinctions and differentiations. And I think one of the big surprises in the relationship has been that I would have thought early on, I think if I had been asked, I would have said, well, I have so much to receive from the Torah and from his wisdom, and I have received so much. But even greater or deeper than that, my experience has been that Rabbi Nachum, for instance, has enabled me to access my treasure in a deeper way and in a way that I had never done before that relationship. So that it is not just, in a sense, foreign truths that we receive through that relationship. We need the other to truly and most deeply access our own truth. And I think that this is, again, something that we already know in the most important relationships of our lives. That these ones with whom we are closest, these ones that we've most loved, they, of course, bring the other into closeness to us. They bring their uniqueness, their characteristics. But in fact, it is through relationship with them that depths within us come forth that we wouldn't know anything about if we had not been true in relationship. So I think that's what I'm most struck by. And I believe this sort of intentionality about relationship and this faithful struggling through difficult patches in relationship bears so much fruit for ourselves, but also for the healing of the world. And I must just share with you a wonderful memory from Elias Shakur. Some of you will be familiar with Father Elias Shakur, who is a Palestinian Christian, and he, when he came to Edinburgh a number of years ago, he began his talk by saying, "We Jews and Christians and Muslims, we are all of Abraham. We are of Abraham. We are of Abraham, who was a good Iraqi pagan." And it was a wonderful way of remembering that you know, we absolutize these distinctions of Christian, Muslim, Jewish, and so on. that they all need to be relativized, because they all, you know, our deep union precedes all of those differentiations. And that's again not to put down those differentiations. That's part of the uniqueness and richness of the tapestry. But we're in a very tragic place when we forget the relativity of those differentiations. I think we have time for one more comment or question.
So, first of all, thank you so much for being here and sharing your morning with us. And my question is around Iona as a sacred place. I haven't been there, but I was introduced to Iona a year ago when I was studying at Findhorn. And every time I hear the word or see the word, it deeply, profoundly moves my heart and takes my breath away. So I'm wondering if you could speak to Iona in your life and its global influence. Thank you.
Thank you. Iona, as probably most of you will know, but just to state the obvious to make sure we're all together, the Iona is this tiny island, 1 mile, 1.5 miles by 3 miles long, that sits out on the edge of the Hebrides in the Western Isles of Scotland. And it is... It was George MacLeod who was the founder of the modern day Iona community in the 1930s and following. It was George MacLeod, I think, who first referred to Iona as a thin place in which the veil that divides spirit from matter or heaven from earth, that veil is paper tissue thin, is what he said, so that Iona is this thin place in which we experience the relationship between heaven and earth. And there, he wasn't thereby meaning that every other place is thick. I think he was meaning that in Iona we taste or we experience that thinness that is essentially everywhere present. So this is not to... very importantly, I believe, George MacLeod's description was not trying to sort of set Iona up here as being more sacred than any other place, but as a type of window or a type of sacrament that leads us into the thinness or the intertwining of spirit and matter everywhere, heaven and earth everywhere. And in George MacLeod's vision, in a way that has really influenced the life and unfolding of the Iona community, the real focus of much of our work and mission as a community has not been Iona, but has in fact been the inner cities of Britain, and particularly working in some of the most economically and socially deprived areas of Britain. Looking for that thinness there, in a sense, being strengthened in vision on Iona, but not in order to stay on Iona, but rather to enter places of real turbulence and lack of peace, to try to embody presence in those places. There's so much to be said about Iona, and primarily I just want to invite you to come to Iona. But one of the other things that I would like to say, because it's quite significant, because Iona is very, of course, associated with the birthplace of Christianity for Scotland and from Iona beyond Scotland as well in the 6th century. But one of the really beautiful aspects of Iona for me, and I think for many, is a knowing that Iona was a thin place and it was a sacred island long before Columba. And in the pre-Christian period, it was also seen as a sacred island, as a place of pilgrimage. It was a sacred island within the Druidic tradition. And when Columba established his mission there, that was very typical of the Celtic Christian world, to honor and to reverence the sacredness that preceded Christianity. And Columba refers to Christ as his Druid. So there's a radical continuity between the pre-Christian and the Christian in Columba. And I think it's something of that radical continuity that we are looking to recover between us as traditions, but also with the pre-Christian, to allow that wisdom to come right into our household instead of being contrary or opposite to the essence of our Christ wisdom. And so Iona was a place where people were coming seeking healing, seeking new beginnings, long before it was a Christian holy place. And in my personal experience and in my personal observation, it continues to be this transformation place. It's been a place of very deep personal healing in my own life in terms of relationship, family relationship. And it's a place where I have sort of humbly recognized or recognized in a way that moves me towards humility of knowing that it has an energy that is much deeper than what any of us individually may be doing there, that invites us into a desire, a sort of sharpened desire for new beginnings. May I offer a prayer? And while we're on the theme of Iona, maybe I could offer a blessing that comes from the Hebrides. And the Hebrides simply means the islands of Bride, the islands of Bridget. And Iona is one of those islands. An ancient prayer for peace. Peace between nations. Peace between neighbors. Peace between lovers. In love of the God of life. Peace between man and woman. Peace between parent and child. Peace between brother and sister. The peace of Christ above all peace. Bless, O Christ, our face. Let our face bless everything. Bless, O Christ, our eyes. Let our eyes bless all they see. Amen.
Thank you so much, John Philip, for being with us. We are all pilgrims. We're all pilgrims, and you have verified for us that we are on the path. This is a very inclusive community, and anybody that's new, please come back. We'll be here next Thursday. But maybe we will all see each other the weekend of February 1st at Casa de Maria. All right, bye-bye.